And you can all hear me fine. There's not no volume issues with my new machine. Okay, good. So let's start. Tonight is the first of a series of six talks I'm going to give on the Four Noble Truths. The reason there's six talks, by the way, is the fourth noble truth is there's so much there that it takes me three talks to say it all. But tonight we're going to talk about the first noble truth. And before I even do that, I want to sort of give a little background, I suppose you could say, about how this came about. Why did the Buddha end up teaching the Four Noble Truths? And it begins, he's a young man, 28 or so, lives in a palace. His father protects him so he doesn't see anything unpleasant ever. He just only has wonderful times and good food, and he's got a wife and a child, and he's just everything is like beautiful all the time. His father intentionally makes it so that that's the way it is. But he gets restless and says he finally convinces his father to let him go outside past the palace gates. And father said, "Okay, but you got to take some guards with you. You can't just go by yourself." So they go riding out, and the first time they go riding out, the Buddha notices this person. He thinks it's a person anyway, but it's all sort of shriveled and bent over and walking really slowly. And the Buddha goes to the captain of the guard and says, "What's wrong with that person?" And the guard says, "Oh, what is that person's just old. When you get old, your body starts to wear out like that." The Buddha sort of takes that in. And next time they go out, there's someone lying on the side of the road and all covered in sores, and they're sort of lying on a pallet, and his family's sitting around him trying to make him feel better, but he's obviously not functioning very well. And the Buddha says, "What's that?" And the captain of the guard says, "Oh, that's someone who's ill. It also happens to people. They get ill, and things. This is another way the body wears out." But it takes this all in. And the third time he goes out, sees this procession of these people, and there's a bunch of people with a pallet carrying on their shoulders, and on the pallet is this body that's really still and not moving at all and looks not very good. And Buddha said, "What?" Asked the guard, "What's that?" He said, "Oh, that's someone who's passed away, who's died, and they're taking him to the ghats to burn the body." And all the people around in this procession are all crying and weeping and pulling their hair, and they're all obviously really, really unhappy. And the Buddha is just stunned by all this, and he spent some time thinking, "Oh, what's going on here? Why is all this stuff happening where people are getting old and getting sick and dying, and all the sadness and unhappiness it causes?" And he's sort of really perturbed, but doesn't know what to do. And then they go riding again. And the fourth time they go out, he sees this man standing there. He's just in a really simple robe. He's got a walking stick and a bowl. That's all he's got. He's got nothing special at all. He looks really sort of a bit poor and ragged. And the Buddha says to the guy, "Well, what's that person? This person, because the person, despite him not having much, looks kind of happy. He's just sort of standing there smiling and talking to people." And the captain says, "Oh, that's a sadhu, a renunciate." And the Buddha wants to stop and talk to him. And he stops and talks to them. And the sadhu tells him about the practice, but there's other things you can do besides just living a life of luxury. And the Buddha is just like totally taken by this idea. And soon thereafter, he runs away from home. In the myths, it's like he has a special horse that can leap over the walls of the palace and he rides away. But he's 29 and he's finally growing up and running away from home. It's like he's a slow starter, but he did get out there eventually. And he goes and he studies with different traditions and he practices for a whole number of years. Eventually, there he is sitting under the Bodhi tree, and he becomes an enlightened being. All the different things he did in between running away and becoming enlightened is a whole other Dharma talk, so we won't go there. But the thing is, he went out there because he couldn't, he had to understand how to deal with the suffering in the world. He could see there was suffering, but he didn't understand how it could be and what he could do about it. And he also understood that it was inevitable for him too. Like this was going to happen to him, which was really the big shock. Oh my God, this is going to happen to me. And he had to understand it. And then he did understand it, being reached enlightenment. And then what did he do? He thought, oh, who can I teach this to? And he remembered the guys he used to hang out in the forest with. And he went and wandered to where he knew they'd be at this time of year in the rains. And he taught the Four Noble Truths. The very first thing he taught was the Four Noble Truths. It was like, it's the Four Noble Truths is the basis of all of the other Buddhist teachings. Everything else refers back to, directly or indirectly, to what he taught that very first time in the Four Noble Truths. It's like the essential. This is like Buddhism 101, but it's also Buddhism like 505. It's a graduate course or something, right? Because it keeps coming back, and you see it in different ways, and you get a better understanding of it over time. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the very last thing you have to do, so the Satipatthana Sutta is the Buddhist teachings on mindfulness practice. And the very last instruction is that you have to understand the Four Noble Truths in some way. And what are these? So the First Noble Truth, typically the Pali is Sarvam Dukkham. And this is traditionally translated as something like the truth of suffering, or all is suffering, or the world is suffering. And this is an incomplete translation, number one. And it's kind of off-putting. When I first encountered Buddhism in my 20s, and there is these people who were teaching, who were talking about how everything is suffering and the whole world is suffering, and I was like a hippie right now. No, the world is all love and sweetness, right? So, and I couldn't identify with it or get it at all. And like, it took me till I was about 50 to really tune into Buddhist teaching. And partly it was like this emphasis on everything is suffering. But if you look at the word dukkha, the word that gets translated as suffering, it actually has lots of other meanings. First of all, if you can break it down into two things, ka, which is a wheel, and du. Think of this as like, these old ox carts that they have and still have actually in East Asia, which have these big round, bigger as the cart, solid wooden wheels. And you drill a hole in the middle of the wheel and fix the axle, and you have two wheels, and the ox pulls the whole thing. So a dukkha is a wheel with the hole for the axle drilled off center. So it means that there you are in the ox cart and riding along, and the wheel is turning, and every time the wheel does a full cycle, it's sort of like, you keep doing this all the time, you're getting, so it's like dukkha is about, you're being jerked around constantly, right? And so it's like, that's a meaning of dukkha that I like, because it sort of indicates, not that it's like suffering is sort of like, oh, it's horrible, and dukkha is just like stuff happens, this is how, this is life, and life basically jerks you around all the time. And so the translation of dukkha I prefer is unsatisfactory or unsatisfactoriness. It just doesn't work very well. Okay. And that I like that because it sort of describes how we often look at our lives. And this seems kind of harsh, right? Even this, even like, not as harsh as suffering, but it still sounds like, boy, this is like life is unsatisfactory. How could that be? I mean, I look at my life. I have all these great things. I just had this great dinner, and I was went for a wonderful walk yesterday and around Coot Lake, and all this great stuff is happening. How can And basically, what this is pointing to is, yes, that's all true. But as the Buddha discovered, we're all getting older, we're all going to get sick, and we're all going to die. And that's the real truth of everyone's life. Basically, as one of my teachers would say, life is a disease with 100% mortality rate. And it's true. It's like we all, this is where we're all, and though we don't want to think about it, and our culture is really good at pretending that's not true. Oh, that's not going to happen to me. It happens to all those other people, right? It's the reality of things. And so it's that sort of existential truth that inevitably everything is unsatisfactory. And then another translation of dukkha is also unreliability. Things in the world just aren't reliable. And we think, well, but look at how that thing XYZ makes me happy. And the thing about it, whatever you can think of about that makes you happy, there's always three phases, there's three steps to any getting anything. There's the time before we get what we want. Always unsatisfactory because we want it now. We always want it now, right? Whether it's a new job or a new partner or a new house or a new cup of coffee. I'm sitting here, but the coffee's over there. I can't have it right now. I got to go get that cup of coffee, right? So there's always that time, whether it's a couple of seconds or like 5 years or whoever knows, when I want something but I don't have it yet. Unhappiness. Then I actually get it. So happy. Just, it really makes us happy. When we get it, it's like that, it's so great, and it is. Like, life is full of moments like that, or times like that, when we get what we want, and it's just like, but what the Buddha said was the reason it feels so good is we've stopped wanting. For that moment, or that little bit of time, now we're not wanting anymore. We're not caught in that unhappy time. Now it's happy. But then, no matter what it is, it's gone. Eventually, everything that we have is gone. Whether it's our stuff, I'm just going through this whole thing with this new computer, but the old computer is going to be gone from my life. It's too old and unfunctional. I'll find some place I can give it to some school or something maybe, but it's just like it doesn't work anymore for me for what I have to do. It's gone. My old con and it's been a big pain trying to go from one computer to the next. It always is. It drives me crazy, but it's okay. Anyhow, so that's just the nature of things. It's like things arise, they're there for a while, and then they're gone. So how can anything like that be something that's going to stop us from suffering? Because inevitably suffering is built right into wanting. It's built right in. It's like it's going to be unpleasant before we get it, and it's going to be unpleasant after it's gone. So there's a time in the middle, it's okay. But everything else doesn't work. My old teacher, Swami Vishnudevananda, had this story he used to tell a lot, actually. This was one of his favorite stories. And this is the story about Liz and Dick. Now, this is like Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, right? Only he called them Liz and Dick. 'Cause they, a lot of you, some of you may not even know who Liz and Dick are, right? But I think we're all of the age where most of us know who Liz and Dick are. But this could be Sean Penn and Madonna or whoever the it couple are now. That you could use the same story, and it would be exactly the same story. So this and the story goes something like this: There's Liz and Dick are walking down the street, and they walk by this jewelry store. And Liz looks in the window, and she sees this like absolutely gorgeous pair of diamond earrings. And she's like, "Oh, Dick, I would just love those diamond earrings are just so gorgeous. I would love to have them." And he just says, "Yes, dear." He doesn't say anything. And "Yes, they're really beautiful." And so the next day, they're out to dinner. Dick pulls this little box out of his jacket pocket, slides it across the table, and she opens it, and there's the diamond earrings. And she's like, "Oh my God, they're so beautiful!" And she puts them on right away, and she's all excited. And at that moment, she's just like totally happy because all the wanting of those things was gone. But then she goes, "Oh, these are worth a huge amount of money. I have to be really careful that someone doesn't steal them." So now she's worried that she's got these earrings, and now she has to make sure no one steals them. Oh, and we better get them insured. So we got to get some insurance. And all these thoughts about what comes next takes some of the joy out of the earrings, just like that. And then the next day, or a couple of days later, she finds out that Dick has actually been fooling around. And she looks at the earrings and she goes, "Ugh, that Dick gave me those earrings. I hate those earrings." Same earrings, nothing has changed at all, except what she associates with them is totally different. And this happens all the time. We have something that we love, and then we look at it and go, "Why do I still have this thing? I have to worry about storing it and putting it away, and I haven't used it in 10 years, but I somehow that I wanted it when I got it." And it's a common thing where we go through this cycle and we think, and this is the point of this, of course, is that we associate happiness with the object itself, and it's nothing to do with the object itself. The object in itself is just an object, whether it's a thing or a person or a job or whatever. It's just some object. And the happiness is when we get it. And then immediately after we get it starts to be a little less happiness and a little less happiness and a little less happiness over time. It's just natural. That's how things are. Everything changes. Everything changes. And there's nothing we can do about it. That's just the nature of how things are. Another meaning of dukkha is simply empty. Everything is empty, devoid of permanence. It's empty in the sense that nothing's permanent. It's a more of a philosophical meaning, but the thing with all these Pali words is they always have like six or seven different meanings depending on the translator and how and it's like you have different sort of flavors of the meaning. And I sort of like this one because like devoid of permanence is a really good way to describe everything. And that makes it dukkha because we want them to last, but nothing does. This is I want to just read this little section from the Satipatthana Sutta. This is the very last instructions in the Satipatthana Sutta. And so this is the last of what's called the Dhammas, the things we have to contemplate. He knows as it really is. This is dukkha. He knows as it really is. This is the arising of dukkha. He knows as it really is. This is the cessation of dukkha. He knows as it really is. This is the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. So that's the Four Noble Truths. But the key here is the phrase, he knows as it really is. So it isn't some abstract sort of idea. It's something that through this practice over time, where we experience it. It becomes real in a very different way than intellectually. It's an experiential thing where we experience really clearly that everything is changing all the time, and nothing, because everything is changing, there's nothing that can make me permanently happy in the terms of objects in the world. But it's more than that, actually. So what does it mean? Know what it really is. This is dukkha. And there's actually three different forms that dukkha takes. And the first of these is called, sometimes called the dukkha of painful experiences, both physical and mental pain, brought on by accident, old age, sickness, death. These are all inevitable for everyone. Fighting against them causes what's called the second dart effect. And actually, this is a classic piece of sutta from the Samyutta Nikaya. And the Buddha's being asked by some of the bhikkhus to explain why suffering seems so horrible. Bhikkhus, when the uninstructed worldling is being contacted by a painful feeling. So uninstructed worldling is us, the people who aren't enlightened yet, right? Okay, so we're semi-instructed maybe, but when the uninstructed worldling is being contacted by a painful feeling, he sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. He feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. Supposing they were to strike a man with a dart, and then they would strike him immediately afterwards with a second dart, so that the man would feel a feeling caused by two darts. So too, when the uninstructed worldling is being contacted by a painful feeling, he feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. So the mental one is something we inflict on ourselves. Yes, our body's going to get sick. Yes, our body's going to get old. Yes, all these things are going to happen. But it's our mental attitude towards these things, how we react to these things, that is a big cause of suffering. This is how we create our own dukkha, in a sense. But and this, it's like the second dart. I like that image. It's like, you got hit with the dart, and so, oh, I got to do something about this pain. So I'm going to take another one, stick myself again. That'll make it better, right? Never works. And I like this image because it's like you're in contention with reality, is the phrase I've been using lately. When we suffer because things happen that are unpleasant, and we think, we think, oh, it's not fair. This shouldn't be happening to me. Should be this is I'm not like this. Why is this happening to me? This is being in contention with reality. Reality is this happens to everybody. All the time. Everybody has to deal with, the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. But we just think, oh, I only should have the 10,000 joys. Thank you very much. No, the 10,000 sorrows, that's for those other people, not for me, right? But the truth is, that's what happens. And by living in contention with reality, it just gets in the way and causes us to suffer more. Accepting these things as inevitable, that everyone experiences them, brings us closer to everyone else. It's our the commonality of all beings. There's no separation. Everyone experiences this. This is the way we start to connect with the sense of connectedness to all beings. Simply by realizing that this is something that everybody experiences without exception. Rich, poor, old, young, doesn't matter what orientation you have or what kind of football team you like or whatever, it doesn't make any difference. Everybody goes through this stuff. And then The second form of dukkha is the dukkha brought about by change. We lose what we want to keep and have to bear with what we don't like. Since everything changes, everything goes through a cycle of arising, being present, and dissolving. We can never succeed in either pushing things away we don't want or holding on to things we want to keep. It's never, we're never going to succeed. Because everything is changing, like literally moment to moment, everything is changing. Yeah. And so once again, by trying to keep saying, no, this relationship, this car, this new computer, they're all going to last forever, right? This is like, no, this is going to be the exception. This is going to be, somehow, I think that this is going to be the exception to things. And then when it does change, which it always will, now we've created our own suffering. It goes, oh, no, my computer's broken down. It's only 5 years old. Oh, no. You know, whatever we're going through, right? Silly nonsense, but it's the truth. You know, it's what happens to all of us. So we're once again in this sort of contention with reality of things we want to keep. And there's a really great teaching. I like this teaching a lot. I just wanted to share this with you. This is called The Five Remembrances. And it's pretty much a classic in the Buddhist world. And it's a teaching on how we can less and less deal with having to deal with the dukkha of change, the inevitability of change, by remembering these five things every day. This is from the sutta. Bhikkhus, there are these five themes that should often be reflected upon by a woman or a man, by a householder or one gone forth. What five? One, I'm subject to old age. I'm not exempt from old age. Two, I'm subject to illness. I'm not exempt from illness. Three, I'm subject to death. I'm not exempt from death. Four, I must be prepared for everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me to not be there anymore. And five, I'm the owner of my karma, the heir of my karma. I will be heir of whatever karma, good or bad, that I do. It's like the only thing I know that's true is that how I act in the world and speak in the world affects what the rest of my life is going to be like. Everybody's going to get old. Everybody's going to get sick. Everybody's going to die. Everything I have that's mine is going to be gone. You know, you can't take it with you is a classic phrase, but it's true. You know, I'd spent a lot of time doing hospice work at one time. And the number of conversations I had that had something like, I used to be able to, but now I can't. Yeah, and it could be like, I used to be able to walk and now I can't. Or I used to be able to like get out of bed and now I can't. And you just, they were all, these people were like, oh, it made them sad that they couldn't do this anymore because they hadn't accepted that this is what happens. It's like, this is going to happen to other people, but not me. Over and over and over again, I saw exactly the same thing. And it was just like, oh, wait, you know, I mean, I wanted to say, hey, wake up, you know, but that's just inevitable that we're all going to have to lose everything. Everything that's dear to us, and not just our stuff, all the people that are dear to us. One way or another, either we're going to go and they're going to still be around, or they're going to go and I'll be around, but separation is an inevitable part of every relationship we ever have had or will have. Inevitably built into every relationship is the fact that it's going to change. It might be way down the line. It might be 50 years from now. It might be tomorrow. We don't know. But that's built into every relationship we have. This is the inevitability of suffering. Because it's built right in. There's no exceptions. You know, there's no special I can't, you can't pay the $1 million to get the exemption, you know. It's like, this is how it's going to be. Everything, everyone, all going to change. And then there's this third kind of dukkha, and I sort of like this one. This is the dukkha of everyday life. Just like going around being regular people. Yeah, everything we do to try and keep it together in the material world. You know, we keep fooling ourselves that everything is okay, often through a lack of attention. We see and value the good stuff and devalue or ignore the unpleasant stuff. And we keep repeating actions and ways of thinking and speaking over and over again, thinking somehow it's going to be different this time. In my university days, a long time ago, true, but I used to binge drink sometimes. You'd be like, you'd be totally wound, and I'd just get like blotto. And every time as I started doing it, it was like, this is going to be such fun this time. And every time at the end, of course, it was totally miserable. I'd be hung over and be sick, and I'd be like, oh, God. And you're just like, it was horrible. But I sort of keep on believing that this time is going to be different. I can get really roaring drunk and it'll be okay. Luckily, I figured that out fairly early on in my early 20s. I just stopped doing that because I could just understood somehow or other that, hey, this doesn't work. But it's like, that's why people have do things like that, because they forget the bad result and remember the fun at the beginning. Going to a party and cutting loose and dancing and being wild was great fun. It just always ended up in the same place at the end, and it just didn't work. That's probably so. In general, for all of these three forms of dukkha, so right, there's the dukkha of painful experiences, the dukkha of things that change, and just the dukkha of everyday life. For all three of these forms, we often make ourselves suffer even more by blaming ourselves. It's my fault that I was so stupid as to get drunk again. Thinking that doesn't do any good because it's past. It's like it's useful if I think, oh, maybe I'm not going to do that anymore. You can learn from your mistakes. But just beating yourself up and blaming yourself, oh God, how can I be so stupid? What's wrong with me? Blah 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 blah. I'm a bad person because I do that all the time. Doesn't do any good at all. And there's another thing built into this thing, this blaming world. And in fact, we've been taught, and this is part of our, well, I'll call this very loosely our spiritual culture. Just, we're all part of the spiritual culture, old hippie, but I can identify with that definition. That everything happens for a reason. Has anyone ever said that to you when things are going bad? Oh, everything happens for a reason. Total nonsense. Absolutely not true. Stuff just happens. Sometimes the stuff that happens is pleasant, and sometimes it's unpleasant, and a lot of time it's totally neutral. It just goes by. But to think that there's some controlling force somehow, that's gonna make things happen, and so I can, because I have to learn this lesson, is just spiritual nonsense. Just some idea, some view that people use to sort of make themselves feel superior often, because, well, you're suffering. You have that cancer because you were bad in your previous life and you stabbed someone in the stomach, so now you have stomach cancer. I know people who actually believe this sort of thing. It was like embedded in their culture. total nonsense. Stuff just happens. To blame ourselves or to blame somebody else, which is the other thing we do. If we don't blame ourselves, we blame someone else. It's your fault that I'm unhappy. It's your fault that I'm suffering. Equally nonsense. And often it's like a misunderstanding of what karma means. You know, people take karma to be, you know, it controls your life. You know, everything's inevitable. And so we think we have no control. You know, no hope. Everything is predestined. This is a common belief of the power of karma. Total, once again, not correct. In fact, I want to read another piece of sutta here. This is the Buddha talking about this very idea. So this is the Buddha again. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at the squirrel sanctuary. Then a wanderer approached the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When they concluded their greetings and cordial talk, he sat down to one side and said to the Blessed One, "Master Gotama, there are some ascetics and Brahmins who hold such a doctrine in view as this. Whatever a person experiences, whether it be pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, it's all said, all that is caused by what he has done in the past. So everything is based on, everything that happens to you now is based on karma from your previous actions, whether it's in this life or past lives. What do you say to this, Master Gotama?" "Some feelings, Shivaka, arise here originating from bile disorders. One can know for oneself, and that is considered to be true in the world. Now, when those ascetics and Brahmins hold such a doctrine and view as this, whatever a person experiences, you know, whether it's pleasant or painful, they overshoot what one knows by oneself, and they overshoot what is considered to be true in the world. Therefore, I say that this is wrong on those part of those ascetics and Brahmins." And then he goes on. "Some feelings, Shivaka, arise from originating from phlegm disorders, from wind disorders, or originating from an imbalance of the three." So this is the medical knowledge in those days. "Produced by the change of climate, produced by careless behavior, caused by assault, produced by as the result of karma, that some feelings arise or are produced as a result of all one can know for oneself, and that is considered to be true." So yes, sometimes karma has some play in what goes on in our lives, but it could be all kinds of other stuff. And when we think everything is caused by karma, that's just sort of like giving up. Oh, I have no control, nothing I can do. Oh, poor me. And you know, people get lost in that way of thinking, where they just think they have no control. Everything that's happening to me is because of stuff that happened in the past. And don't just realize that a lot of what happens is just stuff is happening. You know, the example I like to use: imagine you're walking down the street, you know, you're Whole Foods, you're walking through the aisles of Whole Foods, even better, you know, or your favorite grocery store if you don't go to Whole Foods. And someone walks by beside you, going the other way, you know, going down the aisle the other way, and they're wearing some sort of cologne or perfume or aftershave or whatever, and you smell it, and it's like, oh, that's what that person who I really used to love, used to wear all the time. So that's just that smell of that person walking by wearing that, and you start to remember, and now you're caught up in the whole storm of memory and blah, 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 feeling miserable that that person isn't here anymore or that they treated you wrong. You're telling yourself all your stories. Totally random. This person just walked by, happened to be wearing that cologne, and that triggered all those stories. Has nothing to do karma, like it wasn't somehow predestined. That person would walk by you at, in the aisle of Whole Foods at that time, and you would smell that odor. Just happens. That's how everything just happens, pretty much on its own, without us having any control over it or say in it. It's just things happen. And we suffer because we can't accept that's what's happening all the time, that things are just arising that affect me. We think that somehow I should be in control. What's wrong with me that I'm not in control? I'm supposed to be in control of my life. I'm supposed to be in control of what's happening. If you want to really make yourself suffer, believe that. Because it's inevitable, and stuff's going to happen that you have no control over at all. None. But you blame yourself for not being having it together enough, not being in control enough, that you couldn't stop that thing from happening. What a good way to whack yourself. I mean, you may as well just whack yourself with a stick a few times and get it over with. You know? Doesn't work. But there's always a but, right? All this doesn't mean we should be passive when things don't work out. You know, there we are, just going through life, and something happens, and like, oh, that's it. It's all everything's bad now. And we have to understand that we have to see things as they really are, and from that space of clarity, be able to react appropriately. Yeah, that's what's happening now, but nothing I can do about it. And then so I guess have to be okay with it as best I can. I don't have to like it at all. I don't want it to happen. I have to acknowledge that. But I don't have to react to it and just feel miserable. It's like I have to then go, oh, what can I do to just understand that that's the nature of dukkha. This is the nature of life. You know, that there is 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. And we have to be able to go, oh, that's okay. I don't like it. I don't like it at all. But that's what's there right now, and I have to be, if I'm wise, I don't stick myself with the second dart. I just go, okay, this is what I got. I don't like it. Maybe I can do some things to, you know, fix this somewhat. Maybe I just have to learn to be okay with it, to not be in contention with reality. Of course, have a piece of poetry that expresses this. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Thirst. And I should mention these poems were all written soon after her partner many years passed away. So a lot of them have to do with the emotional turmoil she was in at that time in her life. This poem is called Heavy. That time I could not go any closer to grief without dying. I went closer, and I did not die. Surely God had his hand in this, as well as friends. Still I was bent, and my laughter, as the poet said, was nowhere to be found. Then said my friend Daniel, brave even among lions, it's not the weight you carry, but how you carry it. Books, bricks, grief. It's all in the way you embrace it, balance it, carry it, when you cannot and would not put it down. So I went, practicing. Have you noticed? Have you heard the laughter that comes now and again, out of my startled mouth? How I linger to admire, admire, admire the things of this world that are kind and maybe also troubled. Roses in the wind, the sea geese on the steep waves, a love to which there is no reply. She's acknowledging the truth of dukkha in this poem. It's like quite powerful in its wonderful way. So that's what I have to share with you this evening.